Okay, on the schedule we had for today written that we will talk about Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics, but unfortunately, Atle, sorry, and Georg, we changed the subject because we thought that in 1 hour you don't really have a chance to say much about Wittgenstein's philosophy of mathematics. Well, perhaps you could give a very rough overview, but instead we decided, especially since we have Professor Bilecki present, we decided to try to make some concluding remarks about Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy, and then have some kind of concluding discussion in the second hour. So Alois persuaded me to give this talk, which is based on a talk I gave in Kiev a couple of weeks ago at a conference or a workshop. And for that audience, I thought it was sort of good to have a topic that is very central and also very problematic in regards to Wittgenstein's philosophy. And it is the question about philosophical problems. Wittgenstein's view or conception of philosophical problems, because we could claim that Wittgenstein has a certain idea of what philosophical problems are that doesn't really change. He has already from the beginning this idea that philosophical problems are not substantial problems in the sense that problems in science are. Whereas many philosophers nowadays, and also in Wittgenstein's days, thought that the philosophy is somehow continuous with the natural sciences, and philosophical problems are just like the problems in natural science, perhaps only more general, and especially philosophers of a sort of naturalistic bent also today think that there has to be a continuity between philosophy and the natural sciences, and that the problems dealt with are more or less similar. And I just wanted to focus on this question to a historical incident, and this is the so-called poker incident, which you have perhaps heard of at Cambridge in 1946. This is the only time that Wittgenstein and Popper, Karl Raimund Popper, met. And Popper was invited to the Cambridge Moral Science Club to give a paper, and Wittgenstein was at that time heading those meetings of the Moral Science Club. And Popper decided to give a paper called Are There Philosophical Problems? And Popper and Wittgenstein clashed very vehemently about this question. Wittgenstein disagreed with everything Popper said. And why this is called the poker incident, you have perhaps heard about this. Popper himself describes it like this, that he was arguing with Wittgenstein, and Wittgenstein picked up a poker from the fireplace and started waving the poker while arguing with Popper. And Wittgenstein said, "Can you give an example of a universal moral law?" And then Popper said, "Well, don't threaten visiting professors with a poker." And then Wittgenstein furiously left the room. That's Popper's version of the poker incident. But the people who were there actually have different versions. One version is more friendly to Wittgenstein, is that Wittgenstein usually, when he walked around in the room, picked up perhaps something, and he had picked up the poker to make a point about causality, and he was just having the poker in his hand, and then he got just very bored and upset with what Popper was saying, then he put down the poker and left the room. But anyway, there was this clash between Popper and Wittgenstein, and the clash was precisely about the nature of philosophical problems. And actually Popper gives a sort of account of this debate or this exchange with Wittgenstein in a paper that he published a few years later, a year after Wittgenstein's death in August 1952, and it's called The Nature of Philosophical Problems and Their Roots in Science. And you can see already from the title what Popper thinks about philosophical problems. He thinks that genuine philosophical problems are always somehow rooted in science or relevant for science. And Popper, in this paper, which I guess gives account of the main points he was presenting a few years earlier in Cambridge, he says that, for example, I believe that the function of a scientist or of a philosopher is to solve scientific or philosophical problems rather than talk about what he or other philosophers are doing or might do. He says we are not students of subject matter, but students of problems. And problems may cut right across the border of any subject matter of discipline. And you know, of course, Popper has this very substantial idea of what a problem is. A problem is something that you can try to solve by presenting different hypotheses or this trial and error method. And he thinks that philosophical or interesting and genuine philosophical problems are precisely of the same nature as these scientific problems. But then Popper goes on to ask this question, are there philosophical problems? And then he says that the present position of English philosophy originates, I believe, from the late Professor Ludwig Wittgenstein's influential doctrine that there are none. So at this time, Wittgenstein was quite a strong influence in British philosophy, and Popper actually thinks that perhaps at that time, Wittgenstein's influence was so strong that Popper could claim this, that the present view is that there are no philosophical problems. And as a consequence, philosophy can contain no theories. Its true nature, according to Wittgenstein, is not that of theory, but that of an activity. The task of all genuine philosophy is that of unmasking philosophical nonsense and of teaching people to talk sense. Well, this is, of course, Popper's... It's not completely off the mark, but Popper's knowledge of Wittgenstein was, as most people's knowledge of Wittgenstein at that point, was based on the Tractatus. And Popper has this, he reads the Tractatus through the reception it got from the logical positivists. And that's also where he got his view of Wittgenstein's position. And he actually treats Wittgenstein as a kind of logical positivist. And as you know, Popper was very much against, or he called himself the official opposition of the logical positivists, or the Wiener Kreis. And Wittgenstein was very close to, as we have noted earlier, very close to the Vienna Circle, to Schlick, and well, not very close to Carnot, but still he had a very big influence on logical positivism, even though he never accepted himself the kind of interpretation they gave of his work. And then Popper relates the meeting with Wittgenstein. He says Wittgenstein still upheld the doctrine of the non-existence of philosophical problems in the form described when I saw him last, when he presided over a stormy meeting at the Moral Science Club. And again, just as a historical aside, we can note that Popper here says, when I saw him last, gives the impression that he has met Wittgenstein many times, but this was actually the only time he met Wittgenstein. He was never invited to those discussions with the Wiener Kreis that Wittgenstein had in the early 30s in Vienna. Well, anyway, that's just a philosophical aside. Then he says something about Wittgenstein's later philosophy. I had never seen any of his unpublished manuscripts, which had been privately circulated. And here he'd be wondering whether Wittgenstein had modified what he calls his doctrine. But I found his view on this most fundamental and influential point of his teaching unchanged. And here Popper also makes a perceptive remark, because I think that's true, that Wittgenstein's view on the nature of philosophical problems remained unchanged during his whole philosophy. But of course Popper's view of what Wittgenstein is saying is quite restricted. And then later on in the paper, Popper says that he wants to reaffirm his conviction that the philosopher should philosophize, that it's trying to solve philosophical problems rather than talk about philosophy. If Wittgenstein's doctrine is true, then nobody can in this sense philosophize. If this were my opinion, I would give up philosophy, says Popper. So he thinks that Wittgenstein says that philosophical problems should be solved, Wittgenstein doesn't mean they should be solved in any substantial sense by giving theories. They should be dissolved. We should see that they are nonsense or problematically formulated, instead of trying to solve them by giving, getting additional information or giving new theories. But Popper thinks that this is precisely what philosophy should do, and to do something else is just to talk about philosophy. Of course, he here thinks that Wittgenstein's view of philosophy is similar to the Vienna circles, that philosophy should be some sort of meta discourse. Well, here's Popper's states his own view. He says, my own view of the matter is that only as long as I have genuine philosophical problems to solve shall I continue to take an interest in philosophy. I fail to understand the attraction of philosophy without problems. And then he says that genuine philosophical problems, which he wants to distinguish from pseudo-problems, are always rooted in urgent problems outside philosophy, and they die if these roots decay. And this, even though many people say nowadays that Popper is a thing of the past, we shouldn't care about Popper anymore, I think the view of philosophy he presents here is very much alive, especially in, as I said, naturalistically inspired philosophy. Popper here seems to claim that Wittgenstein completely is of the opinion that there are no philosophical problems. Of course, this is a bit surprising if you look at things Wittgenstein says. For example, here he says something that reminds us of Popper. If one doesn't want to solve philosophical problems, why doesn't one give up dealing with them? This is something Popper could have said, but of course Wittgenstein's intention here is quite different. And we can also note that this is a very late remark from the year of Wittgenstein's death, so about a few years after he had this clash with Popper. But then Wittgenstein's view of what the solving a problem is of course completely different from Popper's. He said, for solving them means changing one's point of view, the old way of thinking. And if you don't want that, then you should consider the problems unsolvable. So here Wittgenstein sketches out what he means by a philosophical problem. It is a problem that appears unsolvable if you don't change your point of view, your way of looking at the problem, your understanding of what you call a problem. Well, and already if you go back to the Tractatus, of course, as you remember, the very introduction of the Tractatus says that the book deals with the problems of philosophy. And then he goes on to say that he thinks that the method of formulating these problems rests on misunderstanding of the logic of a language. And then he goes on to say, at the end of the introduction, I'm of the opinion that the problems have in essentials finally been solved in the Tractatus. And also, and this seems to corroborate Popper's view, he says, if I'm not mistaken in this, then the value of this work consists in the fact that it shows how little has been done when these problems have been solved. The solution of the philosophical problems which Wittgenstein claims he has achieved in the Tractatus doesn't result in new theories. It results in that we understand that these problems rest on the misunderstanding of the logic of our language. And very little substantially has been done when these problems have been solved. Of course, as we have discussed, there's a big disagreement. What has been achieved? Some sort of change of yourself, perhaps, if we want to read Wittgenstein therapeutically. At least, what has been achieved is that you get some sort of correct view of the world, or at least the correct view of what philosophy is about and what logic can be about. And also later, Wittgenstein seems to identify philosophy with philosophical problems. Here's a manuscript from 1933. He says, philosophy isn't anything except philosophical problems. But then he goes on to say that the philosophical problems are the particular individual worries that we call philosophical problems. And then he gives an example of a philosophical problem, such as, how is it possible to measure a period of time since the past and the future are present, and the present is only a point? If we think about this, it seems to be a mind-boggling problem, a very important problem, that we think perhaps can be solved by the theory of what time is and what measuring time is. Perhaps some sort of scientific theory about space-time or whatever we think might solve the problem. But then Wittgenstein thinks that this is actually a confusion to think that this problem is a scientific problem. A characteristic feature of this is that the confusion is expressed in the form of a question that doesn't acknowledge the confusion. And that what releases the questioner from his problem is a particular alteration of his method of expression. So we should somehow re-express the question or look at the question from a different point of view, and then the question will, in some sense, disappear. But this doesn't mean that we have got a substantial answer to the problem. It hasn't been solved in the way a scientific problem is solved. So Wittgenstein thinks that philosophy, in an important sense, has to do with philosophical problems. But the philosophical problems are of quite different nature than substantial problems in the empirical sciences. And he even criticizes other people, or philosophers, or whatever you like to call them, as he says, that to suffer from what he calls a loss of problems. He says, then everything seems quite simple to them, no deep problems seem to exist anymore, the world becomes broad and flat and loses all depth. And what they write becomes immeasurably shallow and trivial. And here he singles out especially Russell and H.G. Wells. I guess he is referring probably to Russell's book called The Problems of Philosophy. You might know this book. And Wittgenstein actually hated this book, but in this book Russell thinks that, yes, philosophy is somehow continuous with science, and those problems that belong to philosophy are just problems that science has not yet been able to solve. But Wittgenstein thinks that this actually means a kind of loss of problems, loss of the view of what philosophical problems actually are like. Then, going on to the investigations here, this is a quotation. This is a paragraph we have quoted many times before. And here he also talks about his aim in the philosophical investigations. His aim, as in the Tractatus, is complete clarity. But this means, he says simply, that the philosophical problems should completely disappear. The real discovery is the one that makes me capable of stopping doing philosophy when I want to, he says. And then he says, the one that gives philosophy peace, the real discoverer is the one that gives philosophy peace so that it is no longer tormented by questions which bring itself in question. Instead, we now demonstrate the method by examples, and the series of examples can be broken off. And then he says, problems are solved or difficulties eliminated, not a single problem. Of course, in the Tractatus, he seems to have this idea that there is the single great problem of philosophy, the problem of the proposition. And when it is solved, then all other problems are solved. But in the investigations, or in the later philosophy, he seems to think that philosophical problems are problems that have to be solved case by case. And they can be solved one by one, and they can be eliminated, but they can't be sort of eliminated once and for all. But also, the point is that philosophical problems are the kind of problems or questions that somehow torment us. That we sort of, if we think of them as problems, then we can't let go of them, but we can't solve them. Of course, this is reminiscent of Kant's view of this, what does he call them? Alois, help me out, the dialectical Kant's view of this unsolvable. Well, Kant's view is that our reason sort of poses as problems that the reason itself cannot solve. But we have to just realize that this...
What do you mean? The antinomies?
The antinomies, and yes. But Wittgenstein, also in his later philosophy, I think, also seems to, begins to think that the very word problem, the way we talk about our philosophical troubles or difficulties, can be misleading. Because when we talk about the problem, he thinks, we immediately think that it is something that can be solved in some substantial way. This is what he writes, for example, in the Blue Book, if you look at the end of this quotation. He says, the very word problem is misapplied when used for our philosophical troubles. These difficulties, as long as they are seen as problems, are tantalizing and appear insoluble. And he wants to contrast this use of problem within philosophy, which he calls a metaphysical, then you use a word without an antithesis, as in the correct and everyday use, problem is opposed to solution. But in the philosophical use, problem is not opposed to solution, because the problems appear unsolvable, if you think of them as substantial problems. And here's another quotation from the early 30s, where he says about more or less the same thing. He says that in the old conception, great Western philosophy, there are two sorts of problems in the scientific sense: essential great universal and inessential as it were accidental problems. Our conception, on the contrary, is that there is no great essential problem in the scientific sense. So all the things that we consider great or essential problems, problems of philosophy, are not scientific problems. They have to be dealt with in another way. And of course he thinks that already in the Tractatus, that the way philosophy has traditionally dealt with the problems is misguided. And that most propositions and questions that have been written about philosophical matters are not false, but nonsensical. We cannot therefore answer questions of this kind at all, but only state their nonsensicality. Most questions and propositions of philosophers result from the fact that they do not understand the logic of our language. And then he goes on to give an example. And then he says, and so it is not to be wondered at that the deepest problems are really no problems. Of course, he talks, for instance, about the problems of life in the Tractatus, and the solution of the problems of life is seen in the vanishing of these problems. We can solve what he calls a problem of life by changing our way of living, but of course that is not an answer that can be put into a propositional form. And he seems to think that the same thing goes for the solution of philosophical problems. But then Popper thinks that this just leads to what he calls the endless and pointless task of unmasking pseudo propositions. And he also thinks that this is the trap which Wittgenstein fell into. So Popper thinks that this leads just to, you know, a sort of fruitless critique of philosophy, to talk about philosophy and to unmask these pseudo propositions. He thinks that this is okay, it's a good thing, you know, to realize that they are pseudo propositions, but philosophy should also be something else. And he doesn't think that Wittgenstein's philosophy is anything else than the unmasking of pseudo propositions. Okay, I think that perhaps, if you want to somehow give focus to the disagreement between Popper and Wittgenstein, it would be the question whether, or how philosophical problems should be characterized, what kind of problems they are. Are they genuine problems with solutions, or are they rather some sort of puzzles or riddles? And Wittgenstein seems to, for example, in this quotation from 49, he distinguishes scientific questions and conceptual and aesthetic questions. And he says that at bottom it lives in a curve where the scientific problems are solved, but not those other questions. So he thinks that, for instance, conceptual, that is philosophical questions and aesthetic questions, have something in common, and that they can be somehow solved in a similar way. But scientific problems are something, or questions are something else. Of course, we can see that in this remark he avoids the very term problem, because it would be question begging, of course, to talk about problems here, perhaps. So, in order to bring out the differences between these two ways of understanding philosophical problems, and also the different conceptions of philosophy lying behind these two ways of understanding, I have a little table, which is, of course, simplifying, but I think it might also be illuminating. So the question is, how should we understand philosophical questions or troubles? Should we understand them as problems or rather as puzzles? And if we understand them, if we want to understand them like problems, in the way Popper does, for example, then the paradigm for a problem is a problem in empirical science. Whereas, for Wittgenstein's view, the paradigm of philosophical problem are the problems of life, or also aesthetic, what he calls aesthetic puzzles or aesthetic questions. They are solved or dissolved in a very different way than the problems in the empirical sciences. And the origin of a problem, in the genuine sense, is, Popper would say, conjecture or observation, a problem situation that is somehow objective, but puzzles, philosophical problems, originate in misunderstandings of the logic of a language, as Wittgenstein says in the Tractatus. And he has a similar view also in the later philosophy, I would like to argue. And the aim of the activity of philosophy would be to solve these problems with new theoretical, by getting new theoretical empirical knowledge, if we see problems of philosophy as problems in the same sense as scientific problems, whereas for Wittgenstein the aim is the dissolution or the elimination, as he says, of the problem. The result of the solution, in Popper's case, is the growth of knowledge and the progress of philosophy in the same sense as science is progressing by solving more and more problems. Whereas for Wittgenstein, as we saw, the result of the solution is a change of attitude, or a way of seeing, or a way of thinking, or even a way of living is changed as the result of solution or dissolution of a philosophical problem. The basis for solution for Popper would be to get new facts or information through observations or experiments, whereas Wittgenstein thinks that the philosophical problem can be solved by rearranging things or reminding us about what we actually already know. And nature of the investigation in Popper's case would be experimental or theoretical, whereas in Wittgenstein's case, well, here we have different interpretations of what he is actually trying to achieve, but at least when it comes to the Tractatus, we can talk about some sort of analytic investigation. Some people think that Wittgenstein also in the later philosophy does practices sort of analysis. At least in the later philosophy, we can talk about a grammatical investigation, or even perhaps some kind of therapeutic investigation, the aim of which is to somehow cure you from these problems or questions. And the list goes on, it could be even longer, but the nature of the solution in the scientific case, it's formulation of general theories, more knowledge about nature. Whereas in the puzzle case, it's more about the clarity about our use of language, or some sort of Übersicht in the later philosophy of a particular region of language. Or what Wittgenstein calls sometimes a synopsis of triviality, is a rearranging of what we already know. And the criterion of success in Popper's case would be correctness, solution of the problem. Whereas in Wittgenstein's case, it would be agreement, that I actually agree to the way of formulating or reformulating the problem. The scope for science is general, but in philosophy, at least in later philosophy, it's local or case by case. The method of the investigation for Popper, both in science and philosophy, is hypothetical deductive. But Wittgenstein says, for instance, in the investigations, that there should be nothing hypothetical about this investigation. It's purely descriptive. Or in the Tractatus, he talks about elucidating. And the approach in scientific cases is reductive. We try to find the causes of things, whereas in the philosophy case, it's non-reductive, or not trying to find causes, but rather describing reasons. And then if you want to put a bit of a Habermasian perspective on this, you could talk about the knowledge interests involved in it. If you think about philosophy as solving substantial problems, then we want to explain, or perhaps predict, and control things, whereas in Wittgenstein's case, a knowledge interest is at least understanding. It might also be thought of as emancipation, at least if we put very much weight on the therapeutic view of Wittgenstein's philosophy. Emancipation would be that we get freed from these tormenting problems, when we understand that they aren't problems at all. The attitude in the scientific case is disinterested and impersonal, objective, whereas in philosophy there's always this, for Wittgenstein, this personal engagement. The philosophical problems are problems just because they are problems for you, they torment you. They are not, you cannot take a sort of disinterested attitude to them. And the nature of the difficulty in the scientific case, it's an intellectual difficulty, as Wittgenstein also puts it. But philosophy, he says, the philosophical difficulty has to do with the will. It's a change of will that is demanded in order for you to be able to look at philosophy, or look at the problems, or look at the world in a new way. It's not really an intellectual problem. We had some disagreement with Alois earlier about whether the word puzzle here actually is a good one to use, because of course if you think about jigsaw puzzles and so on, they are quite trivial, and Wittgenstein doesn't actually use the word puzzle very many. He talks about philosophical puzzlement and so on, but one reason for me to use the word puzzle here is that actually in the invitation to the Moral Science Club, the invited speaker was invited to present the philosophical problem or puzzle, and then to engage in a discussion about it. And I think probably that was Wittgenstein's own formulation, that he wanted the discussion to be about puzzles and not about problems in this substantial sense. And of course Popper took that as a challenge to talk about problems instead. Well, if we accept this kind of view of philosophy that Wittgenstein presents, as opposed to this other kind of view of philosophy that Popper presents, then you of course get the problem or question about can philosophy make any sort of progress, or is it, you know, the solution of purely personal problems in some sense? And Wittgenstein seems to be very critical about the idea of progress in philosophy. Do you remember the motto for the investigations, which seems to be critical of the idea of progress? There can be different interpretations of this motto. Does it talk about philosophy on the whole? Does it talk about Wittgenstein's own philosophy and so on, or both? At least, I think his view of philosophy is very much in contrast both with Popper's and the logical positivist's view about philosophy, because also the logical positivists thought that philosophy can make real progress if we understand that philosophy is not a science, but has to do with the unmasking of pseudo propositions and the advancement of logic and the formulation of meta-languages and so on. But here, Wittgenstein did, in the early 30s, actually have a sort of idea that philosophy can make progress, and that he himself has discovered something in philosophy that makes real progress. This is just a resume from Moore's notes on Wittgenstein's lecture, and according to Moore, Wittgenstein said in the early 30s that what he's doing is a new subject. It's not just one step in a continuous development. It could be compared with what happened when Galileo and his contemporaries invented dynamics. And Wittgenstein had said that a new method had been discovered, just as chemistry was developed out of alchemy. But this is a sort of, it's an optimistic moment in Wittgenstein's thought in the early 30s. Then later he becomes much more pessimistic about the idea that his way of doing philosophy actually is some sort of progress or a new paradigm for philosophy and a new method that can be applied across the board. But still, both in the Tractatus perhaps, and especially in the early 30s, he had this idea that philosophy can actually make progress by solving or dissolving problems. And by applying a certain method of analysis or a certain method of investigation. And this is also from the early 30s. He says that you always hear people say that philosophy makes no progress, the same philosophical problems are still troubling us. But here he says that the reason is that our language has remained the same and also always introduces us the same questions. And then he gives examples, as long as there is a verb be, which seems to work like eat and drink, and so on, as long as people speak of the passage of time, and so on, people will always run up against the same teasing difficulties, and we start something which no explanations is able to remove. So, again, I guess we can read this that in the sense that the real problem with philosophy is that you don't understand what the philosophical problems are like. And people think that they are big unsolvable problems, but actually they can be dissolved if you just change the method of philosophy in some sense. But later, as I said, he grew more and more pessimistic about this idea that his way of philosophizing can actually achieve this kind of progress. The progress would be, of course, that we sort of stop falling into these traps language puts to us. But later, I think he got more and more pessimistic about this. This is a remark from the late 30s. Where he talks about the sickness of philosophical problems. And he says that the sickness of philosophical problems can be cured only through a changed mode of thought and life, and not through a medicine invented by an individual. And then he has this interesting example about the motor car producing or encouraging certain sicknesses, and mankind being plagued by such sicknesses until, for one reason or another, or for some cause or another, the result of some development, it abandons the habit of driving. So here he seems to suggest that it's really impossible to get rid of these philosophical problems one has and for all, unless there's some radical change in the way we live and think. And then I guess new kinds of problems would turn up. So if you look, give this pessimistic interpretation to Wittgenstein's philosophy, he would say that, you know, philosophical problems can just be dissolved on case-by-case basis, but they tend to always come back, and we have this tendency to ask these questions, and they have to sort of be, the philosophical task is in that sense never-ending, and it can never be, philosophical problems can never disappear by through using a certain philosophical method once and for all. The pessimistic view would be this kind of therapeutic view, perhaps also that, you know, you can, through this therapy, get cured or better, but the therapy has to go on. You can never, it's like in psychoanalysis, you can actually never stop the therapy. There's always something to talk about. Whereas the more positive view of Wittgenstein's philosophy would be that the philosopher can somehow, by doing these descriptions of language, guide us through language or all these problems that language seems to create, and that we can somehow get the correct view of these problems and in that sense dissolve them and get rid of them, at least temporarily. Okay, I think that's more or less. Oh, well, that's. Just a final question or comment. Of course, the disagreement between Popper and Wittgenstein, it's not merely a semantical disagreement. It's not like, okay, I use problem in this sense, you use it in that sense, and that's okay. But of course, it has big consequences on how we understand philosophy or what our conception of philosophy will be. And it has also big consequences for the interpretation of Wittgenstein. If we think that this is what Wittgenstein means by problems, then when Wittgenstein says something like, in his early philosophy, there is this single great problem, the problem of the proposition, or when he writes to Russell and says that the cardinal problem of philosophy is the problem between saying and showing, then if we think that Wittgenstein means that the problem actually is something that should be dissolved, then he could mean, by writing that to Russell, that saying, the distinction between saying and showing, actually is something that we should get rid of. Whereas the other way of reading is actually that, okay, this is the most important thing that we could philosophize about, and that we have to make this keep this distinction, and somehow show how, for instance, in logic, this distinction plays a very important role, that the tautologies show something that cannot be said, and so on. So, how we understand Wittgenstein's use of the word problem is, it's not merely, you know, it can also have big consequences for how we understand Wittgenstein's philosophy and what he is actually trying to achieve, for example, in the Tractatus. So that's more or less what I had to say. We can now take a break, I guess, and then discuss more generally Wittgenstein's view of philosophy. Okay, thank you.